Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello, I'm James O'Brien. Welcome to Unfiltered, which for episode 26 features the comedian Russell Cain. He, like all the coolest people, has got a podcast which is out now called Evil Genius under the auspices of the BBC. It's a brilliant idea, but I've met Russell once and I think he's an absolutely fascinating man. Let's hope that by the end of this interview, my theory's been proved right rather than wrong. It's a tough one, this, because you put so much of yourself out there.
I know.
That, where does an interviewer begin?
If you do expose something and make me uncomfortable, I'll sure as hell be turning it into a touring show next year. So you can't win today.
Because, I mean, this is no exaggeration. For people who aren't completely familiar with your work, traumatic divorces, short marriages, personal crises, sliding down the fridge,
yeah,
in a state of emotional collapse. It's all there.
I don't have any really juicy ones, which I constantly... No. I'm saying, shall I purposely take heroin for a year? I don't have any really juicy addictions.
This will go out after my interview with Irvin Welsh, who spent a significant part of talking about his addiction to heroin for a year. Almost like we plan it.
In my world, as long as you're recovered from it,
yes,
it's great. So, undivorced parents, I wasn't abused. I was upper working class. All I've got is I've got flat feet, i.e. probably you've got Ehlers-Danlos type 1, and I'm slightly chavvy. I mean, that is minority. And the Essex thing, that is a stereotype I sort of play with.
You didn't get on well with your dad growing up, though. I mean, is that not...
We were just different, I think. Because sometimes when I phrase it like that, people see two, like, warring people.
I did.
But I think sometimes... As you'll know, if you go to a dinner party and you get sat next to someone who you've just got nothing in common with, he's not a bad person. It's just enough for the, like, your shoulders are rubbing, knocking each other's cutlery. And we were just opposite people. I'm like a carbon copy of my mum. My mum looks like me with a perm on. My dad was 6 foot tall, steroid taking, weightlifter, doorman, lifeguard, model at one stage, BNP voting, very right-wing, metal-welding lump of Essex steak.
Seriously?
And I'm a sort of literature-loving, skipping, glittery question mark, is my son gay type boy. So we were just on different planets.
When did that become clear? Can you remember? When did it...
What, the opposite?
Yeah, when did you... Because most... I mean, great, some, your dad's your hero for...
I look at pictures where, when I'm sort of new, like a baby, and see my dad cradling me, like one of those, you know, the male gorillas who just has a moment of tenderness with the moonlight glinting off their silver fur at the back. And I find it... It's going to sound... You've gone deep already, James.
That's what I'm here for.
I find it hard to identify with that image. I've got no memories of the baby dad image. My dad, from as young as I can remember, was like, I was working when I was your age. He's obviously lying and exaggerating.
You're like five at this point.
Yeah, I was working in utero when I was inside you. Then You know what I mean?
Imagine, man. Not a happy man, then.
It was all about life's a struggle. Do you know what I mean? People will let you down, boy. Law of least effort. People will crush your dreams. People always waiting to shit on you. And everything was difficult and a struggle. And but it was when I hit 11, 12, and the puberty emotions kicked in, and my rebellion was to read books or
sensitive,
or then to smoke wacky backy Jamaican smoke. I mean, then it really did kick off. So my dad was like straight edge bodybuilder, still going down the gym three times a week. He popped his clogs at a young age from a birth defect that was undetected.
Oh, Lord.
The man went on a birth defect to age 63. I mean, that's what you call with a will to live.
It's interesting because already I'm thinking you are determined to see the positive. And yet, what you described was actually pretty negative. So the analogy of sitting next to someone at a dinner party who you don't like, it doesn't bear that much resemblance to what you just described.
No, it wasn't a positive experience at all. It was a funny experience. Right, and I think when people laugh, that's a positive emotion. So I could produce positive emotions, but I for the first five tours, felt like a fraud. I didn't write a word of stand-up. I quoted verbatim and told the story like you would tell a mate down the pub without any art of it. This is my natural way of speaking.
Yes,
I don't really change it when I'm on stage. So people are like, you're a genius. I'm like, it's got nothing to do with me. My dad's the one that, when I was 18, he now and again he had these what I call four Stella Artois moments where a softness came over him and a wobble head. He went, come here, boy, I've got something I want to tell you. Like the other man just would show himself just for a second.
Yeah.
You know I never tell you, but... You know what I mean? And I like, he's getting so close to saying, I love you. And then he went, I just want you to admit, and this is what he said, I never hit you, have I? I've never laid a finger on you. Like, that to him was the greatest achievement.
Sure.
I never hit my son. And I was already, like, trying not to laugh.
Yeah.
And then he went, do you know why? And I thought, oh, he's going to say it now. And he went, because if I started, I wouldn't fucking stop. Do you know what I mean? The size of me, boy. I couldn't trust myself to continue. And that was the end of that tender moment.
How bizarre.
My childhood is full of these unintentional bits of comedy.
And were you seeing them from the outside even then? Were you seeing them as...
No. I don't think... No, because when I first started stand-up, I was doing the first couple of years when I was doing amateur spots, and I got this bit of a coup called... It's called Edinburgh and Beyond, where they put four comedians together... who are all up, one who's very new and one who's up and coming, who is Russell Howard, and they put you all out on the road together. And in the car, on the way to the gigs, I was telling them this stuff about my dad.
Right.
And Russell Howard was going, what? Are you mad? I've just watched you do 5 minutes about masturbation and you're making us cry laughing in the car. And I'm like, I can't tell this stuff on stage. Who's interested in my dad? And then I realised, I'm sitting. I went like that, dunk, 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 and there's a gold mine. I was sort of, you clear the dirt away, and you're like, I'm rich, material-wise. I'm rich. That's
family.
It, it's still going. I'm going back in this year. I'm developing The Fast and the Curious at the moment, and two of the biggest stories in there are about my old man again.
When did you lose him?
2003. So my dad died before I even started stand-up.
Sort
of spitefully. I'm going
to
pass away.
To
I don't want to see you achieve anything.
Alternatively, he might have been mortified to see the...
Yeah, he couldn't take a joke. So my mum loves it. She finds it hilarious. But he was an older dad. He was a lot older than my mum. My dad was the same age as my nan, in fact. So that's the same age as my mum's mum. But yeah, I can point to anything in this room and I know what there's a laptop there, there's a phone there, and I know what my dad would think about it. Waste of money, rip off. When I got a mobile phone, I had about a 5 minute speech about that.
Yeah.
Waste of money. Why do you need to be on the phone when you're on the move?
So what were you, as you grew up in this house with this astonishing contradiction between your two parents and your eggs, as it were, pretty much all in your mum's basket?
Yeah.
Were you walking on eggshells? Were you frightened of setting him off, or were you...
So, like I said, and like my dad said, I never laid a finger on you.
Right.
I only saw him shout a few times.
Okay.
It's like those teachers that don't need to raise their voice.
Yeah.
He just didn't need to. I never answered my dad back once in my entire life, in his entire life, and I never saw anyone ever answer him back, apart from my nan, my mum's mum, who I eventually moved in with when I was 19, when I couldn't take it anymore.
No.
Who was an alcoholic. And I'm allowed to swear on this.
Yeah, of course you can.
I can't talk about my nan without swearing. She got into the car. My dad's like a straight-edge bodybuilder.
Yeah.
So she's got into the car smoking in my dad's Merc. And she's blowing smoke in the front of the car. And he went, put the cigarette out, Joyce, when you're in the Merc. And she leant forward and went, fuck off. And I swear to God, it's one of the few times in my life I've seen hairs in each in turn. Ding, 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 ding. Because my nan was like, you know the Pepper Army character? Yeah. That's what my nan was like, just a Pepper Army with hair on. I thought he was going to kill her. It's the only person. And something I should put it in this year's show, actually. Scott, my best mate, was telling me that they used to take it in turns to... We used to go knock for each other when we were 15, 16, yeah. And go over the park. They used to take it in turns to knock at my house because no one wanted to risk it would be my old man that would come to the door. A man that never shouted, never raised his voice.
So he just had an air of menace. Yeah. He just had a constant air of menace.
He was obviously a big bloke. He must have been 16, 17 stone, 5% body fat. Yeah. And it was just, he came to the door.
We've done 25 of these. You're the 26th, unfiltered. And one thing that's happened quite weirdly... is themes have emerged unexpectedly, like connections between the guests. And what you've described is very similar, actually, to Robert Webb's childhood.
Yes.
And yet you have gone down very different paths subsequently, but that very domineering, potentially violent father, but not violent.
Emotional and violence is a form of violence that gets overlooked sometimes.
I think you're right.
Unintentional.
And you having this very artistic side, but... trying to nurture it in an environment where it was considered to be a negative rather than a positive.
So Robert and I have that in common, particularly growing up in like this hetero white. I mean, I am straight, but you know what I mean. That sort of overly hetero white culture of if you get caught reading a book, you might as well get caught in
exactly.
a dress.
Yeah. So you were in Essex. He was in rural Lincolnshire.
The difference was, if I'm remembering my Robert Webb biography correctly, his mum was a teacher or something.
Yeah, there was an intellectual input.
He had that working class but literature in the house type glint, whereas I've had to do it with nothing. Not that my mum just didn't know about this world.
Yeah.
I remember asking my mum what came after A-levels once, and she didn't know. So there was no books in the house, there was nothing. So I was not just one bootstrap, I was double bootstrapped. I was the first person in my family to get an A-level, and then the first person to get a degree.
Let's go back before that then. So primary school, and this would be new territory for you then. You arrived in education without any points of reference.
Primary school, I was top of the class all the way through.
So you knew you were clever from a very early age.
From nursery, which is the age, I've got a two-year-old daughter now, and she's apparently exactly like me. So my mum said, first day of nursery, all the babies are clinging to the mum's legs, and I was like, bye, gone. Could not wait. Bored, shitless.
Clearly.
I've been bored my whole life. This is the first time, the last 10 years of my life, where people have actually spun my hamster wheel fast enough to tire me out. Before that, I'm like that. Even when I was in advertising, really...
We're jumping forward again. I was still in primary school. You've already started your career. No, I understand.
I could see it in my daughter. Bored. She's bored the whole time. Bored. Next. What's next? Not. They don't need to give it a label. It wasn't ADHD because I had no problem with my concentration.
Right. So if you had to sit down and do a two-hour shift, you could.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people watching now are going to be thinking exactly what you just said.
No, I love being tasked up. I love learning a language. I love plowing through a long novel slowly. I wasn't getting that intellectual weightlifting I needed at
home.
So from nursery, I was absolutely, bing, top of the class, and it lasted till I was 11.
Well, let's not jump the gun, but I'll tell you what I'm thinking of rather oddly. Do you remember that film Short Circuit?
Yeah.
Number 5 is Alive. Yeah. You need more input.
Yeah, was it.
More input,
That's
more input,
like.
More input.
That's what it's like. And I always thought by the time I got to this age, it would slow down, but I swear to God, even though I'm an atheist, I swear to Dawkins, it has got worse in the last 2 years.
Has it really?
I think it's going to end some sort of zero event sort of thing where my mind folds in on itself.
Well, also, you're very politically engaged, and politics has been nuts. So if we were to overanalyze it now and see it as some sort of quest for understanding, the stuff that's happened in the last 2 years has made understanding feel more out of reach than ever before, and that might be what's set your wheels spinning.
But so, the primary school got the raw, I think... This is why I've got such a problem with our education system. And this is why we go about education all wrong. Whenever we do something in this country, and we go, we're going to change it up, we're going to change sex education, we're going to change racial education, we go to secondary school. Why are you bothering with 11-year-olds? I feel sad for them, but it's game over.
Pretty much.
Fucked, done. You won't find a study on the planet. All the ingredients that decide what the acorn will grow into pretty much goes in between 3 and 11. I know it's heartbreaking. Mm. I know you want to think your dad walking out on you when you were 13 is what did it. But most of what we've got was done that forms us, that you've got to fight back from or grow into, is between 0 and 11. that's when sex education should be, that's when XYZ should be, it's when racial education, all of that stuff should be happening at primary school, but we'll never do it because we've got this leftover of the innocent blank slate. Yeah. I mean, they did an experiment on Channel 4 recently where they took sex education into secondary school and all the parents complained. I'm using sex education because it's the perfect example of how we misunderstand how kids' brains develop.
Well, you probably shouldn't even call it that. That's part of the problem as well, because it makes grown-ups, especially repressed grown-ups...
Which is England.
Which is mostly... United Kingdom. Yeah, which makes them all cross their legs and go peak Victorian, doesn't it?
But you can almost draw a graph and plot the age of sex education with the rate of teenage pregnancy. It almost tracks... in a line, and guess who's right at the top?
We're
there?
Not anymore.
No, quite near the top.
Well, quite, but we've had a good decade. It's halved in 10 years. It's moving in the right direction. But you're right. Reluctance
in Scotland, they can now teach in primary school, whereas most of the schools in England
still
can't, because the likes of, I'm not having to go at Melanie Phillips. I think she's a clever lady. Still going on Question Time and saying things like, "Why would you put thoughts of sex into a 6-year-old's head when the thoughts of sex aren't there to start with?"
Do you know
what ridiculous logic? They're not thinking about the Tudors either. No. So let's not teach them about Henry VIII or anything.
And also, of course, if what I use on the radio show with the religious fundamentalists is if something that isn't supposed to be happening is happening to a child, and they've been told at home that it is supposed to be happening and it's normal, how are they ever going to know that it's not normal?
No.
Unless someone at school is talking to them about it. This is where the NSPCC stuff is so powerful. This is going to be an interesting interview, isn't it? I'm going to have to try and remember where we are.
Sorry.
So, no, it's fine. What happened at 11? Why did it all suddenly go? Because you were a teacher's pet.
My point is, between 5 and 11, my natural, raw, animal curiosity, I was able to be...
Was harnessed and fed.
Because it was fine. The second you got to... I was 11. I went to the local comprehensive. If you live in a poor area and you go to a comprehensive, you better hope you're not brainy.
Right.
You better hope to God you're not brainy, because you will get the living shit kicked out of you. Or, if you're clever like me, you'll learn to be funny, go into the middle sets and survive and come out with, if you're lucky, a couple, an A, a B, a few C's.
And if I'd spoken to you then and said, are you... keeping your light under a bushel, are you pretending to be less clever than you are? Would you have had the self-awareness to say yes?
I think I would have told you, I don't find that shit interesting anymore. I want to be the cool kid. That's what I want to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At my school, it was, who's tried weed? Who's lost their virginity? Who can beat who up? They're the boys that got the female attention. They're the boys that were popular at my school. That's just the way it rolls. Really uncomfortable for lefties like me who think grammar schools are evil. But the reality is, if I'd been skimmed off at 11 and put with other bright chavs, I would have absolutely smashed it and done a web and gone to Oxford and Cambridge and all that. But I wasn't. I was put into this pot of mixed ability boys, and in that pot for a temporary 5 years, I honestly believe, particularly boys, value system inverts.
Right.
It reverts again when they're 21. Of course, you should have passed my exams.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, between 11 and 18, your value system spins on its head if you're from an ultra working class, council estate background. I've always wanted to be popular. I'm a stand-up, for Christ's sake. So I did what I had to do, which was I associated more with the tough crowd, and I survived. I was never accepted by them because I'm too nerdy, but I wasn't bullied. I pulled through.
How did you work out what you needed to do then if you weren't bullied? Because another previous guest, John Ronson, talks about being really bullied, and for very similar reasons to you, albeit he was at a Welsh comprehensive school, but he...
They don't work. And I know it's controversial to say it. Comprehensives don't work for people like me, but they work for more people than they don't work for, so I have to keep my mouth shut.
And that's why you support grammar schools whilst simultaneously knowing that you don't. There's a cognitive dissonance because this system would work for me, but I appreciate in a utilitarian sense.
We live in a private school system where the value of your house is pegged to the quality of your education.
Yes.
Anyone who doesn't believe that is kidding himself. If I spend a £2 million house, I'll get a £2 million education at the local comprehensive.
Yes.
Fact. Sorry if it's uncomfortable.
It's not. I don't think it is uncomfortable. Back to the bullying that didn't happen to you, because it did happen to John, and he talks about it in a very similar way to you do, and almost like the curse of cleverness, although he had I don't know whether I'd say he had more confidence or perhaps he had less desire to be liked than you just described. So he ploughed his own furrow, but he tells a story about being stripped naked and thrown into the playground at about the age you're talking about. How did you work out that you needed to have these survival mechanisms if you never really felt the full force of the bullies or the nastiness?
I know John's worked very well. I've been to see him live and read every single word he's ever written. So I'm very familiar with John, and we're very different people.
Yes.
I won't judge. We're not born equal. Back to the grammar school education question again. Wish we were. And I've always been funny. Like, my daughters like it now. I've always done voices. I've always done impressions. I've always been able to worm my way into people's affections by cracking jokes. Yeah. So I just used that. I've never been shy. And I was able...
And what were you frightened of, Russell?
Well, at my school, for example, if it was your birthday, you did Tunnel of Death, which is where all of the kids, all of the boys in the top bracket would line a tunnel on the wall and you'd run through it and get kicked in. And my birthday was in August. So right. I used to live in absolute fear that I'd get like the... In September, people would remember.
That you're owed one.
I mean, I was punched and punched right. on the arm and thrown over benches, but only once in a blue moon.
Right.
So the fear was...
That you'd become the regular.
That would become
target.
Regular. So I...
Can you remember the kids who were regularly
yes,
brutalised?
I would say I was in the league just above the league of boys. You know, the ones that smelt of wee or yeah. looked at the ceiling or got beaten up or were into Dungeons & Dragons, which I loved and had to hold off till I was 16
told
to play. That liked chess and, and that were... Well, I am brainy, I don't care. They took the... They just, their arms were just blue the whole time. It was always on the arms so it could be hidden.
It's a funny thing, that. And it hasn't changed, has it? In many ways, we seem to be moving backwards. This refusal to venerate intelligence. It's so bizarre.
But
it's
you go
so
into
defeatist.
You see it time and time again, the working class boy who goes to the grammar school makes it to Oxbridge. So there's obviously something there. And then we have to listen to all these politicians going, well, I went to a comprehensive. And do you know what a pathetic 0.001 exception you are? Mm. You're not helping the debate. Mm. How can we make education work for everyone? My mum and dad, both secondary moderns, right? So I'm not back in that system.
Sure.
They had shit educations and they hated school and they were dumped in a bin aged 11. Not acceptable. But I basically switched off from 11 to 18, but came back hard at 18. But I might as well have just stayed at home and read books.
So GCSEs were a bit of a no.
I still got an A in English.
Yeah.
I left with 5 GCSEs.
Right.
It's criminal, really.
And you did your A-level somewhere else?
I did my A-levels at the local college which was just an excuse to not have to go to work.
An A in English GCSE against the backdrop that you've just described is worth...
So I like books.
I got an A, but I was at one of the most expensive schools in the country. So for me, your A is worth 10 times what mine
maybe.
Is. Well, genuinely it is, because, you know...
Mine's an R.
Exactly that. But so you knew, this is what I find fascinating, and you still do. This is the tension, really, right inside you, is between who you are and where you are, almost. So you knew you were really clever.
At this point, I still didn't have insight into my condition.
Okay.
So as a psychologist would phrase it, I thought, I'm winning. I have dropped out on purpose, the system. I want to be one. I'm quite happy being the funny guy. Books. I'm not a gaylord. I'm going to go and get a job. I'm going to make my money in the world. But first, if I don't have to work till 18, I'll go to the local weed MDMA acid college around the corner, which is all you did. You just got high there and do... A-levels, which I didn't attend hardly. I attended the minimum lessons
to not get chucked out.
So basically left with nothing. I got 1D or something. And then it was into the real world.
And what happened then?
I'm writing a book at the moment. I've never really written this. I call it like a reverse nervous breakdown.
Go on.
A nervous build-up. So I left and I've always had a gift of the gab. So I said, my mum, I went on the dole for a few months and my mum's like, it's not happening, you need to get a job. I'm like, right, it's awful, I don't condone drug use, but I've still got diaries where I'm in the back, I need £10 for petrol, £5 for some weed, Rizzlers. I knew exactly how much I needed to get through the week. And so that's it, I've got a job selling watches and I've retained a passion for watches my whole life. I'm wearing a very understated Oris today. And I got a job set in the Watches of Switzerland. Quickly worked my way up. I was in the Rolex showroom selling Rolexes, which I still adore to this day.
I remember this. I won't let you lose your thread. But what is it? I've never got this thing with watches because I'm going to sound like a crap comedian when I say they all tell the same time. What's the appeal?
Well, I don't have a single manly thing about me. I hate sport. I don't know anything about cars.
Sure.
I'm rubbish at weightlifting. But
no, sure.
But watches, because I sold them and learned so much about them and got passionate about selling them, I accidentally was radicalised.
Got you. Yes.
And I, for a Rolex, for example, it's 18 months from when that oyster case is made to when it leaves the factory. It's got more parts than a Ferrari, I believe. I believe that to be true. They're just fascinating machines. They're beautiful works.
But this is more input again, then. This is you just not realising how much information there is attached to a watch.
Horological absorption.
You're sucking it in.
Anyway, so...
There you were, flogging Rolex.
There I was, selling Rolex. I mean, you know, I was a glorified shop boy, but a good one.
Yeah.
And I felt, I wouldn't have recognised it as Marxism at the time,
right,
a growing resentment, particularly if the customers were English, posh mum and dad, posh kid, graduation present, choosing a nice wash. I was like, there's them and then there's my lot. Lovely. I started to dawn on me which path I'd taken. This is when it the starts to wake up. Then everything was about the Saturday, going out clubbing on the Saturday,
yeah,
raving, illegal, strawberry sundaes in Vauxhall. If you were there,
yeah,
you were there. It went off like a left open fridge every weekend. And there I was, had a few sherries, shall we say.
Of course.
Looking at my skull. This beautiful girl comes across the dance floor, about an inch taller than me, model. Just hands me a number like that. Me, a nobody,
yeah,
19 years old. I phone her. We start dating. She comes from the them team.
Right.
Not overly posh, but posh. She's doing her first semester at university. So a lot of the time I was waking up to go to work in halls. Something,
yeah,
I'd never thought. I know the university was something you went to, but
right,
my only contact with university was watching the Young Ones.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought students were. And of course, I'm waking up in halls, looking out of the window before I go and get my annoying 7:30 a.m. train or getting in at 6:30 p.m. and seeing people sat on the lawn,
yeah,
when I got back from work, books, ideas. What time are you up tomorrow, Quentin? Oh, I'm up at 10:30. I've only got two lectures this week. And I'm like, I have been robbed by my birth.
Bloody hell.
I have popped out of Julie Kane, and it has been decided at that moment that I would work in a shop, just like my grandma worked in a shop, just like my mum's a cleaner, just like everyone in my family has done this, that and the other. And I thought, no fucking way. Not with the software that I'm not using. Fuck off. So I waited till I was 21, because the bar drops for unis as soon as you're a mature student.
Right.
So I knew you need one A-level,
yeah,
as long as you can ace the interviews.
So you were doing research now, you were looking into it, you were finding out. Hang on, I've got two things. I've got the people coming into the shop. I worked in a shop.
That was the start of it.
No, but I worked at a shop at the same time, and they used to talk French because they'd think I wouldn't be able to understand. They'd be buying the graduation suit for their son. It was when I was trying to break into journalism and I was stuck in menswear. And I know the people you're talking about. So you'd feel resentment towards them, but then when you started dating this girl and
burgeoning,
seeing the world that she lived in, there wasn't resentment there. There was aspiration.
No, I think there was aspiration mixed with an anger as
right,
well. It's a... If I had to draw an analogous example based on what's happening today with the Me Too stuff, it's,
yes,
like, oh, my God, I was assaulted. I
right,
didn't realise.
Yeah, okay.
I was sociologically assaulted and I had no clue. There you are, council estate. You're going to do that for the rest of your life. Comprehensive, into the system, into the sausage factory. And I've got it in my diary.
Go on.
I was smoking a cigarette. I was on a fag break down in the smoking room. So I'd woken up at Zoe's that morning,
yeah,
and I stubbed the cigarette out and I wrote in my diary, today's the day it changes.
Shut up.
I went home that night. This is just before the internet. This is, yeah, this would be 96, 97. Internet was just started. And I found out you could do A... Obviously, I had to work full-time.
Yeah.
I found out you could do A-levels by postal correspondence. I was living at my nan's at this point.
Yeah.
That's another story. In a housing association flat in a box room, no wardrobe. Stoned every night on sherry. And I sent off for A-level sociology because I thought, this is what's pissed me off here. It's not a subject I know anything about. It arrives in these three boxes, which I'm supposed to study over 2 years.
Mm.
3 months later, I was sat as an external student in my local college, which means you're literally on a slightly separate table.
Yeah, I remember.
And the invigilator inspects you. I got the fastest ever A grade from enrolment to graduation in sociology for the last 5 years. I won an award, which was given to me by Betty Boothroyd. My mum still got she was the Speaker of the House of Commons at the time. And with that A level, basically I had my pick of the unis I'd applied to. But I chose to go to the one that I thought would keep this energy going, this enthusiasm.
Right. Okay.
So I could have gone and done anthropology somewhere posh, but I was like, I don't really care what the mountain Arapesh tribe do. I do care about English,
yeah,
and journalism, which I wanted to go into at the time, and writing. Now, at the time, there was only one undergraduate degree that had a vocational, because I'm working class, so I was obsessed,
yeah,
it must have a vocational,
yeah,
punchline. So that's why I went to Middlesex. It was down the road from my nan. And I
that'd
know
Comp Foster's,
people might turn their nose up at Middlesex, but I knew it was the course for me, and I was right. I was the only person to get a first on my year.
You just fast-forwarded 3 years. You've
but
done
it went like that for the whole
what
3 years.
What did your mum think about this plan?
They all thought it was great, because there was no risk involved.
No, but oh, OK, so they would just see it as something instead of staying in the watch shop or doing...
Yeah. By this point, my mum was more or less a kid when she had me, so by this age, she knows about university and
okay,
stuff and bettering yourself and
yeah,
is totally behind me. So I went there and where I'd had 3 years to prepare, I'd saved up enough money in my bank account so I could draw out £80 a week, every week from the cash machine, and I wouldn't need to work in the summer holidays.
Right.
That was my secret weapon. So I pre-read all the reading list before semester started, so I was still able to attend every party. I was able, I never missed a pound a pint night. I never missed a party. But first, I just aced it because I was angry. It was aspiration, but it was like...
I didn't know this about
it. It was like, fuck you, Chaucer.
At every turn. Do you not think that maybe your dad felt the same way and just reacted to it in a completely different way?
Your
dad
went down.
Felt mugged.
He did the, what's the point, into
yeah,
the seat.
Exactly.
Whereas I did the, martial arts.
Because if you hadn't watched your dad, maybe you wouldn't have had it within you to be... cross.
Maybe not. I mean, I did some weird shit during those 3 years. So, because I was behind all the private school kids, so they would turn up. And people don't realise how much you can go through education having missed everything.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's embarrassing to admit this on camera, given that I'm doing things like Goodread and hosting Open Book and stuff now. People talk about Jane Austen, and I'm like, I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know who she was.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'd read kids' books and then gone to... My education stopped at 11.
Yeah.
So I literally went from A to Z, like the autodidact in that... I think Sartre wrote a novel called Nausea with this idiot character called the autodidact. I went from Austin through to Zola and I kept going back, just one novel on the go.
Sure.
And just reading the biographies until I caught up and then overtook.
And were you getting nourished by them? You're not just doing it like cramming the night before an exam. You're doing...
No, these weren't studied novelists. I was doing my work...
No, I know, but you're not doing it just because you felt I want to be a person that's read 100 books.
Yes, no, I was doing it because I want to feel I've been a person that's read 100 books. And not only was I doing that, and this is the worst one.
Go on.
Every time I encountered a word I didn't know, when would I? I come from a council estate, my education stopped at 11. I wrote it on a card, and I carried that card with me until it was in me and not being artificially brought out.
Why do you describe that in such a negative way?
Because it's embarrassing to be like a... I won't name another comedian, but you know when you feel some comedians are using long words for display rather than for their intrinsic meaning?
Does it discombobulate you?
And someone who learnt words after the age of 21, there's always that, but that's not your... They're not your real word. Like, they weren't my words. They were the words of those other people.
Words are the weapons that you have to break out.
And they wound sometimes. Thanks, Cher.
Accidents of birth, aren't
so
they?
The first card, I'll never forget it, was Impudent.
Yeah.
From Pride and Prejudice, and I had the word Impudent. And because of where I come from, and because I didn't want my friends at uni to know, I had no... There's no internet yet. I had to learn the phonetic alphabet. That could be Impudent. It could be impudent, I didn't know.
Yeah.
So I had to write down I learned all the phonetic symbols, and then I also had the cognates, impudence, so I wouldn't fuck those up, and the meaning. And I would have them on the toilet, and I'd write it. And once I was like, I know that one now, I'd get rid of the card. I must have got, it was a habit I found hard to shake for several years.
Why would you want to shake it? Because maybe not that level of
there's
studying.
Something, and I'm not using this word to be offensive, there's something autistic about... Learning the word impudent and then going in and having a conversation.
I see what you mean. So it becomes like almost obsessive, collecting, rather than an end, rather than a means to an end, it becomes an end in itself.
And I knew it was organic when I was using a word, and I was like, was that one of the ones from my cards? Or I don't know. Anyway, the person was being really impudent yesterday. Now it seems so absurd. And in fact, I burnt them. I was so ashamed.
Did
I burnt them
really?
When I got to 30. I burnt all of them, which I could kick myself because I could give them to my daughter now.
Of course.
But I was so embarrassed.
She's going to be reading books from a very early age, so she's not going to end up with the gaps that you...
But it was like I'd done a cognitive raid on the palace.
Yeah.
I'd gone... And I took them all and I went to the extra plays and things that weren't on my course. Once my course changed to the creative thing in the last year, I went, of course, because that's what I've been training for my whole life.
So it worked. You left Middlesex and you went into the kind of job that you never could have got without having gone to Middlesex.
And I was so glad I did that rather than anthropology at Goldsmiths or whatever it was I got into, because I finished in the May, got the... There's two of my proudest achievements, and the Comedy Award I won.
Not surprised.
Still proud. And I got that first. I was like, what do I want to do? I wanted to be a novelist or a freelance journalist. So I thought, I'll become a teacher.
Right.
So I've got my holidays.
Yeah.
Plus, I've always had this primary school thing I'm passionate about. So I thought, I'll become a primary school teacher. Not enough men in primary school teaching. So I signed up to a PGCE, but I was headhunted within a month of leaving college for an ad agency. Because how many unis can you go to look for graduates who are both good at English and vocationally good at English?
Yeah.
Not many.
So this would be as a copywriter? You were headhunted as a creator?
I was.
What was that like? What was the tap on the shoulder like?
It was crazy. I was doing credit checking in the holidays just while I was waiting for my PGCE to start.
Yeah.
I got a phone call from my tutor, that was the novelist Suji, wonderful writer. And she phoned me and was like, are you sitting down? There's an ad agency. It's pennies, 100 quid a week. It's an 8-week placement, but what an experience. And they don't really have a job, but they might make one if you're right, sort of thing. And I was like, well, we know how this is going to finish. Because I'm fucking like... It's like I've been in, since that cigarette, like I've been injected with something. It was quite that energy, which I thought at my age now would have stopped, but it's...
And it did.
Like if we have a meeting with Joe after this,
yeah,
and it was, we could do this thing, I'd be like, yeah, and then the series would work like this, and then I'd be annoying as fuck until it
You wouldn't
happened.
Be annoying at all, it's infectious. No, it's genuinely, you spend a lot of time apologising for who you are, and you don't need to, do you, really? Why do you still have that? It's probably your dad still, is it?
It's probably partly the comedians always...
There is that need.
...double-checking the order, trying to be one step ahead of the heckle.
Yeah.
Maybe it's that.
So were you any good at advertising?
So I started on £100 a week... 18 months later, I was head copywriter in the agency. 18 months after graduating, I
want to tell you something very briefly, that we've learned an awful lot about you, and you've listed an astonishing catalogue of achievements. You haven't once seemed even slightly boastful. I don't know how you've quite pulled that off, to be honest with you.
But given the opportunity, I will, I can't believe... But it's because I sort of can't believe I've done it.
Right.
I'm a bit like... A lottery winner isn't like, yes, I'm rich. A lottery winner's like, I'm rich! I'm like that. Oh, my God, I've got a first.
Yes.
Oh, my God, I've done it. I'm head of copy. Because no one's ever... I'm not getting the violin out.
No.
But no one ever told me, you're amazing, you're going to solve the world. In fact, I was told quite the opposite.
Yeah,
so it's always a pleasant...
So you're winning at advertising.
I became head of copy. I won't be obscene and talk about money, but
why not?
It was crazy. I've come from.
And your mum was still working as a cleaner at this point.
My mum was. Yeah, she's done dinner later, cleaning, childminder. So I can't remember exactly what my mum was doing at this point, but probably I think she was cleaning. And I was in an ad agency, so it's all good. My dad was like, can't believe it, boy. Fucking hell, serious moolah. This is about. It's 2000, 2001.
Yeah.
And that was it. I did what my generation don't do, bought a house, bought a flat. I'd made it, as far as I was concerned.
But it's such a short amount of time, Russell, from that cigarette to the mortgage.
Yeah, so the cigarette would have been 96, and I was buying
a
flat
by 2000.
By 2001, I was buying a flat in Clapham. So I had pedigree cats, hummus in the fridge. I was sat on coloured couches in the day going, what about if we run from this idea? I'd been, like in Star Trek style, the middle classes have gone, OK, then, beamed up. I mean, I still sound like a moron, thank God, because it's a funny accent. But I was consumption.
There's a lot of people who put a lot of effort who went to public school and trying to sound like you do now, though, isn't there? There's a lot of people almost culturally or socially moving.
We meet in the middle of the estuary.
In the opposite direction.
So I was there.
Were you happy? Were you satisfied? Or were you just pinching yourself every day or what?
Pinching myself, I think personally that your 20s, for most of us, aren't the best decade of your life.
Mm.
You still got a lot of that self-harmy, weird goth shit going on, either literally or figuratively. And that's why I personally think the best decade of your life probably is 30 to 40, where you still look young, but you can laugh. So I was still partying a bit too hard.
Sure.
It was still all that.
It goes with the territory, doesn't it, in the advertising industry?
Yeah, and you know, obviously I got... It wasn't like my parents messed me up, but I would say I was still quite a complex person at that stage. Didn't find it hard to make relationships successful, but I was happy.
You did. You liked yourself. You liked who you were.
I liked my work.
Right.
I've never had explicit feelings of disliking myself.
No, of course.
But there were now and again behaviours which weren't right.
Got you.
So, for example, nothing menacing, but like if I lost, I don't know, if something silly, like I couldn't find my house keys, it wouldn't just finish in a slammed door.
Yeah.
I'd have to take it to the next level. I might put a hole through a wall.
Yeah.
I might be in a bad mood for 2 hours because of a traffic jam. It's like something obviously wasn't quite right in the tuning with the regulation of emotion.
Yes.
But overall, I was, if you ask my friends, they'd be like, really? You were the happiest person out of the group.
Right,
like,
okay.
Because I love work so much, I was flying high. But there were behaviour patterns that were spinning out of control with temper and plummeting, which I did fix eventually.
How?
I did a Hoffman residential course and
really?
Changed my life.
You see yourself almost as a constant work in progress, something that can be constantly improved.
I think all people should.
Well, so do I, mate. Yeah. But it's rare to meet someone who's so upfront and honest about it.
You should
and
do, yeah. That came later on. I'm happy to talk about that. But at this point,
probably not going
to
have time.
At this point, I'm flying high. It's 2001, yeah. And then I would describe what happened next as it reminds me of an advert that was on when I was at school, where they tried to scare you from trying heroin. Where you saw the needle go into the arm and it went into the bloodstream and it was like, at first you'll be sick, but you'll soon come back for more. That's what happened to me. Someone said to me at work, why don't you try stand-up? The way you write copy and come up with headlines, you make people cry laughing, you lead all the pitches, all of the girls, you got nothing about you, 5'10", you got all the girls queuing up, you should be a stand-up. And it's something that had completely passed me by. It wasn't on my cultural menu at a weekend. Like, should we go out for a curry or should we go? And then when I got older, it was clubbing, skin up over the pot. It just wasn't there.
No.
I've never heard of the Edinburgh Festival. Went through the whole of uni as an inverted snob. Didn't even have a TV, just listening to Radio 4, reading Penguin Classics. And plus my uni, one of the few in the country that didn't have a stand-up club.
Right.
So it had passed me by.
Gosh.
Now I'm in middle class London where people are like, hey, we're going to the open mic night. I knew it was in the background, didn't know what it was. Just knew I was a funny bloke.
Yeah.
Didn't know I'd been practising it my whole life.
God.
And my friend, the creative planner in the agency, was like, please, just try stand-up. I just know you'd be ace it. So I just thought, like you might do a bungee jump or you might strip off and go through a field once, just something to tell the kids one day. I thought I'd try it. And that was my needle in the arm heroin moment. After that, my life, career-wise, temporarily, fell apart. My relationship fell apart, my career fell apart, because I became obsessed, like someone does with a drug.
Overnight. Tell me about that first time on stage.
Well, it was average. I got a few laughs, but the first laugh was the heroin in the veins. I was like, what was that? I've never had that pure level of, we like you, mainlined into the frontal cortex, serotonin, dopamine, engaged. What the fuck was that? I mean, I'm not a public speaker.
Sure.
I hate it. I was eating boxes of Imodium. I mean, not a natural stand-up in front of a group. Good in a small group. Biggest show off you'll meet in a small group.
Yes.
But in front of 100 people shaking, literally throwing up. Again, the drug analogy follows. And I felt this hit, and I was like, the ego, the one, like you said, that's not very good at being boastful, came out and went, oh, fucking have some of that.
Right.
Next day, I had the Time Out magazine. How can I do free stage time? Who's doing a gig? There's one in a pub. I'll do it. Filming it, showing friends at work what I'd done. Yeah. It's all I talked about. And of course, the copywriting over that year starts to go down. I was doing things like finishing work at 11, at 6 in Fulham, driving to Manchester, doing a 20-minute unpaid spot, driving back, and then going back to work the next
day. The word that springs to mind here is manic.
It's manic.
Yeah.
Because I sound so Billy Elliot and cheesy.
Shut up.
But I just knew I was home. I thought I was in the copywriting, I was happy, but I knew I'd found.
Wow.
Every single person has that thing that they are the fucking A-grade supposed to do. You've clearly found yours, if you don't mind me saying. Okay. And I just knew. I knew I wasn't the best out there, and I might never be the best out there, but I knew this is the seat I was supposed to sit in. And once I found my material, that was it, Perrier Award, and I just had to leave work, and I was off. That's when my mum had a problem.
Because you were turning your back on security, longevity.
First person in the family to make it. I've got this flat.
Did you want to be what? A stand-up comedian?
Because it was at the start of X Factor, where dicks stand on a cross and think they're going to be successful just because they feel like they should be.
Yeah.
And I thought, am I falling for that?
It's my destiny.
Am I falling for that destiny logic? I thought, I've got to go for it because I've got enough good stuff on my advertising CV. Yeah, it's only 5 years, but I've got enough there, I reckon, for two. If I do this for 2 years and it goes wrong, I think I could go back and have
like
a career.
Safety net. It felt like a fallback position.
So I saved enough
up. Who did you confide in at this point in your life? Who would you lean on? Who would you talk to, if anyone?
I don't think there was anyone.
So
not really.
This is doubly. This is jumping out of an aeroplane with it.
Maybe a couple of the guys at work, they're encouraging me.
Yeah, but it's amazing when you leave a job how quickly these amazing bonds and friendships can just, not through any fault or criticism, they just wither a bit, don't they? And they cease.
My girlfriend at the time was, of course, as most women should rightly be, women and men should rightly be, are threatened by this.
Right.
Suppose all of a sudden this guy you've been getting your dinner from the supermarket with is standing and having all these strangers coming up to him going, oh, God, how long have you been doing it? And girls going, can I have a selfie? You know, it's only certain types of people can deal with that.
Yeah.
So we were split up. I did my first gig in the August and we were split up by the October.
Really? Because that is not who she wanted. That's not who she started going out with. You begin to change it.
There wasn't enough time for her. Yeah. My dad died in that time just as I started stand-up, so I was out going through a lot of stuff. And I lasted 2 more years at the ad agency and I was like, I've got to try. And I still to this day cannot believe. I got up at 10 a.m. today.
Yeah.
Do you understand how profound that is? I got up at 10 a.m. I'm a grown-ass man. Yeah. It's a weekday. I'm working, I got up at 10. If I wanted to, I could have phoned the other thing I was doing this morning, Jolly, and pulled out and got up at midday.
Yeah.
What the fuck? I've won. I've won.
Except it's not a prize you valued when you were more input.
No, but by the time when I did stand-up, for the first year, I honestly skipped downstairs and would do, like, visualisations where I'm like, just keep focusing on how lucky you are. And I still do that before I go on stage. I sit there and I focus. I see myself sat in the office and I jump around. That's how I get myself energised.
But you loved working in advertising.
Oh, yeah, I did. But I think I loved the work, but now I've got the work and personal adjoined.
Yes.
If you find your hobby,
yes.
Like I'm doing my hobby for a living.
Sure. And the freedom is the word that keeps shining out of you, actually. There's a freedom here.
Yeah, I just love it.
Possibly you didn't even know existed, and which your dad, I think, did know existed and knew it wasn't for the likes of him.
Yeah, or he'd like to have got hold of it. Funnily enough, my dad did Butlins one season and was a red coat or something.
Well, there you go.
So it was there. But it takes you from 1996 to 2003.
Right.
Complete, just crazy change.
Incredible. Absolutely. I had no idea. I'll be honest with you. I mean, it's filmic there. So you're writing
I'm writing a book at the moment, autobiography type.
Yeah, you should.
But it's all based, if I'm being totally honest with you, and as you will be, on a sort of chip on the shoulder, immature Marxist, resentful anger was the fire, and on top was the.
But you've done it again, mate. It's not immature. It's not resentful.
No, but it was a bit stupid. It was
stupid. Why is it stupid?
No, stupid.
Oh, okay. Unsophisticated.
It was a sort of man, the working man. It was all born of that. That's all gone now.
Right.
Now I just realise it's there for the taking. And what annoys me is we don't get into the primary schools of young working class lads, white and black, and open their eyes and show them.
And give them an alternative to what's happening at home, where they are often being told, don't be daft, don't be soft, don't be gay. That's not for the likes of us. You shouldn't be doing stuff like that. Man up, pull your socks up.
How can the number one indicator still be what your mum and dad do for a living?
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
Yeah.
How is that based on your individual random genetic... I've obviously got something genetic that's gone in my brain that's different, which made no difference. I was working in a shop. Just a pure accident unlocked... There's nothing wrong with working in a shop. My family do it. But what I'm saying is, I wouldn't have done all this amazing shit. What a waste to have missed it all.
It is. You're right. And a waste that you wouldn't have even known was being wasted while it was wasting away. So how quickly after leaving the ad agency did possibly your mum realise that you'd done the right thing? Not just you, but where it actually made sense to people who care about you.
Because he's
jumped out of an aeroplane, but my God, that's some parachute.
I left in March 2006 with enough savings for 6 months for the experiment. Paying my mortgage and everything. And everyone, the ad agency, like my creative director, my managing director, all thought I was insane.
Even the one that encouraged you to trust?
No, not the creatives loved it.
Got
but the bosses,
bean counters,
like, I would have made creative director. I was clearly going there. It's a 200 grand a year job when I was a kid. And they were like, what are you doing? I just knew I had to do it. That was March.
Right.
In July, I got a job for Channel 5. They started a channel called 5 US. It's still on now. It might be called 5 USA. And the programmes are slightly shorter on 5 USA than they are because they have more adverts.
Yes.
So they needed a comedian to appear in the adverts going, I'll tell you the thing about Las Vegas. So I got flown to Las Vegas, New York and Los Angeles, first class that I've never experienced in my life.
Sure.
And that was my first job. It really took a lot of willpower not to phone work and go, fuck it. That was my first job. And then I went and did my first Edinburgh show that August, nominated for a Perrier Award. Newcomer. I was like, bang, we're off.
Very different material then to what you do now.
Not by then.
Now you were doing the personal stuff.
Not quite in 2006. I was being personal. Being myself. But I hadn't quite fully unlocked the dad stuff.
At one point you had an on-stage persona. You had, like, makeup and...
That was a real wrong turn.
Though. Yes.
So that 2000...
We've missed the wrong turn, have we?
That's 2011.
Oh, okay. I've got my chronology wrong.
So 2006 is when I first started. Yes. I just looked normal like I do now. And people were like, the energy, it was a bit Lee Evans-y, but a bit sociological at the same time. So I got recognition. I got nominated 4 times for this bloody award, Perrier Award. Second most proudest moment of my life. I win it in 2010. Can't believe it. And then it goes... turns all what I call like Ramesh Rob Beckett, where everyone wants you on everything all the time. I went into that phase. So I made a couple of decisions where I did shows where they were sort of stylized I was like this gothy sort of impresario, and I encouraged it. But I wished I'd had someone having my back going, mate, you might want to stop doing that because it looks a bit like you've got a bit of telly and you're turning into a cunt. I can't think of a better word.
That's right.
No one was telling me that. I needed a bit of guidance, man. I'm fucking just an idiot from a ghetto who suddenly has got the world going like that.
Yeah.
And I just, my instinct is to show off. It's all I've done my whole life. It's always worked before. So I did an exclusive with one channel, which was another mistake. I should have played across the way what some of the other comedians brilliantly do. And I guess I just... When I realised what I'd done quickly, I was like, shit, let's not do any more of that, and pulled back again. But I just had a little bit of a wobble for a year where the show off went into pretension.
Right.
I would say.
And the personal life also wobbled around this time.
I don't think it likes to wobble as much as I've made out in interviews and on stage.
Okay.
Because that sort of lets me off the hook a bit, you see, if I say that. Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
Whereas really, I think I probably just became a bit of a dick who was loving the attention, and I was like, I'm going to dress a bit more like Noel Fielding, he's really cool.
Yeah.
And I just lost it, basically.
You lost sight of you?
Probably, just only for a year.
Sure.
And then my relationship did break up at the same time, but I don't, if I'm being completely honest, it lets me off the hook to pretend it was related. It was just a relationship that had run its course.
Yeah, okay.
And then but the bad coincidence was it was the first time I'd ever been single in my life. I've always had a girlfriend. I'm like, I love you after one date person since I was 16.
Yeah.
So, of course, I've my first year of being single.
And famous.
And people like me should not be single.
Yeah.
So I did a year of that, and I thought I was going to have like steel pins put in my pelvis or something. It was bad, mate. I was working really hard, TV, and I could not have a night off. I couldn't just sit in my flat and watch a sci-fi and have a curry.
You had to go out and...
It immediately went to me, you could be with a girl now.
Right.
You could be having sex with a human female. That's never worn off.
Sure.
It was amazing when I was 15, the idea of it. It's still amazing now. I'm married and I'm still like, I'm going to have sex with a woman. it's just never worn off for me. For some of us, it doesn't. And
so you were led around by your dick for a year. Really?
It was bad, really. I mean, I'd be way too scared to behave like that now with everything that's going on.
Sure.
But it's so recent, but at the time it was. I've never been addicted to anything, and I thought, am I? Is that behaviour compulsive? Becoming... So I thought the next date I go on, and the heart does that. I was wearing what I could describe as an emotional condom, so that I didn't feel anything.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So the next date I go on, and I get I'm going to go on a second date, and that was it. That was Lindsay.
You fixed yourself. You fixed yourself.
Well, no, I just let go. There was a couple of girls I was like, I quite like her, but I made a promise to myself, I'm going to have a year of being single.
Right.
But when it was Lindsay, I was like, no, I've made a promise, let's go on a second date. Third date, fourth date, bang, gone.
And Lindsay was in the front row of one of your gigs.
Yeah, she was in the front row of a Chester gig.
Yeah, mate, every chapter of this story is almost unbelievable.
2012.
Yeah.
She was sat there with her mum and dad in the front row. I was It was a year of being single, and I just pursued her, basically.
And?
Although, in fact, she'd left the theatre.
Really? So you just clocked how much you fancied her at this point?
I'd had a, like, I'm sort of fluffing the chronology a bit. I'd had a sort of mini relationship in between.
Right.
Sort of one that went on slightly longer.
Yeah.
And I'd just finished that. And I was in the front row and I saw this girl, and as you do to the front row, you're horrible to them, even more if it's a girl you fancy, because men grow up so well. horrible, really. I made rude. She's like, Lindsay's from Manchester, but she's quite well-spoken and posh like that.
But hail.
So, and she had this fake fur jacket on her leg, which I pretended was real fur to the audience, and I was laying down and pretending that she was so posh that when she waxed her minky, actual real fur came on, and her dad's there laughing and her mum's laughing. And I ran off stage and I was like, I bet I never see that girl again. I was only sort of recently out of this mini relationship. Sure. So a couple of weeks later, I just tweeted the word minky.
Yeah.
Just, I didn't hashtag the gig, nothing. I just and I got a reply to a tweet from a girl I didn't recognise saying, I think this refers to my friend, because she's been using that word laughing in our group. Was she in the front row of your Chester gig? And I was like, is she on Twitter? Yes, she is. Follow. And then we didn't meet up until a good few months later because we were busy and everything. We went out on a date in the April, May.
Bada bing.
And that was it.
That's lovely.
And I said to her, look, this is who I am. I'm not going to be one of the bastards. I am sleeping around, total asshole. That's what this is today. If you can't handle it, throw a drink in my face and leave. She went, you know what? Let's just have a drink together. Nothing's going to happen. Let's see how it goes. And we went like that till the August. And in the end, I was like, I can't help it. I'm in love.
I love you.
And then there's my wedding ring, which on the inside says, you had me at Minky. So there you go.
Can't say
romance is not dead.
It's lovely. And I knew this was going to happen. We've got to shoot over the time. So, personal life in a wonderful place. Career where you want it to be?
Yeah, like I said, I think I was going like that, which maybe I would never be able to handle. And the idiot spiky hair lied about my age as well, something else I did. Wearing the eyeliner, I think that pulled the nose down, which is a good thing.
Yes.
So now I'm change management. I'm with... Off the curb. Yeah. I mean, that's where you want to be, man.
Yeah, of course.
I don't want management,
as in looking after you and having a word in your ear.
It's the Manchester United. I don't want them to get a big head because they might watch this, but you look on the walls, Michael McIntyre, Lee Evans, Jack D, they've got Jonathan Ross, they've got Robin.
And they're looking at you 10, 20 years down the line. They're not just trying to cash as many chips in as they can off your back, like some managements and some agents do. So everything's good. We need to talk briefly about the reason why you're here.
Danny, he hates being...
He's not going to let me.
Danny hates existing. He just said to me, comb your hair, put a suit on, finish puberty. So I did. Best thing I ever did.
That's just brilliant.
Now I'm busier than I ever have been, grow up, get married, have a kid, sort your life. Why didn't someone get me in 2011 and just do that? Because I would have listened.
You know better than anyone about being in the right place at the right time and the moment actually presenting themselves. So tell me about Evil Genius, the new podcast, which is...
Yes.
This is where the interview goes vaguely professional for the last 5 minutes. It's been a real pleasure.
I've done all of this telly and all this touring, and then what you do now and again is you take a year off and you go invisible and you do lots of things you've always wanted to do, like develop sitcom scripts, blah, blah, blah. So I've always had this idea I wanted to do with Radio 4, and I never got to share it with them. So I got one of the big Radio 4 producers out for a drink, Sally Heaven. She does a good read and all those things. And I said, I want to do a programme where we take famous dead people from history. It could be Einstein. It could be Richard Pryor. Charlie Chaplin, and my panel roughly know who we're going to talk about. I have to do the research, and then I keep throwing evil stuff about them to try and mess up their perception. Or if we have an episode that works in reverse, we start with Margaret Thatcher and I keep throwing good stuff.
Yes.
And at the end, they don't get to say, I think it's quite complicated, you know, Thatcher did something, they have to vote evil or genius. It's like a parlour pub game.
Yeah.
It's like a parlour pub game that I played with my mates. I never could have imagined it would work how it has. First of all, Radio 4 came back and was like, how about we do it as a BBC podcast, which is a new thing they're doing, which is better, really.
Yes. And, gives you room to breathe.
It's just been amazing. It really puts people on the spot. The discussions have been really funny. And as we're talking now, we've gone straight up into this, a top 10 podcast here, which I've never achieved before. I've done a few podcasts. So, you know, we're sitting above Desert Island. I'm absolutely buzzing.
10 years from now, do you have any... Because it seems to me that you actually have had, up until this point in your life, almost excessive levels of planning and plotting, which you've pulled off from the moment you stubbed out that cigarette in your girlfriend's hall of residence.
True.
Is that still there? Have you still got...
Yes.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm top of I'm playing in the, I hate football, Coca-Cola Championship type thing. I don't care if I don't.
Yeah.
But I would love a stab at the next level.
Stadiums.
We're doing...
Type thing.
I think I would like to do one before I pop my clogs.
Yeah.
Maybe just a London one. I wouldn't do anywhere else in the country because I'm not that comfortable in them as a gig.
Right.
But I've heard the acoustics at Wembley aren't bad. And I mean, I'm in that 1,000 to 3,000 seater range.
So yes.
My goal for the next 10 years is to do another free tours, just selling the same tickets.
Yes.
I would high-five the shit out of myself in a decade time. Something else I really want to do before the nursing home, a sitcom.
Right.
I would love to do a sitcom, and I'd love to be in a movie.
Sitcom, do you have an idea what about?
I'm developing a script right now.
Does it have anything to do with your own childhood and background?
It's based around my old man, yeah. And if I can be a Mrs. Brown's Boys and play my old man, it would be the ultimate Freudian closure.
Well, there we are. Mate, that was an absolute joy. Seriously. Russell Cain, thank you so much.
Cheers, mate.
Oof. That was Russell Cain live on Unfiltered, and I can safely say it was a little bit like having a tornado in the studio. If you enjoyed that a fraction as much as I did, you'll probably want to subscribe to Unfiltered immediately and hear all the other interviews, the 25 that you've missed. You can do so wherever you downloaded this podcast.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.